This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour.
Welcome to The Conversation Hour. I'm Georgie Coghlan, filling in for Rochelle Hunt, who's on a much-deserved break. I'll be here for the next few days. It's great to be with you. It's certainly been an exhausting week, hasn't it, with the extreme heat and, of course, several bushfires are still burning across the state. We'll keep you up to date with all of the latest information on the fires. And I imagine for many of you it was a sleepless night, so hot. So we thought today, let's maybe take a breath and chat about some lighter topics and something that will hopefully put a bit of a smile on your face, including whether or not you would wear a flannelette shirt to work. Are you allowed to wear a flannel to work? I'm a country girl. I wouldn't mind wearing a flannel shirt to work, particularly in winter. I want to hear your thoughts on that. Also, would you be happy to win the prize of the world's ugliest lawn? I certainly wouldn't, because I am pedantic about how my lawn looks. I love it to look beautiful. And a new study has suggested that our students need more outdoor play. Should our schools have more outdoor play to help our students become more resilient and be better in the classroom?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Welcome to The Conversation. Now, if you're anything like me, you're probably getting your schedules, your timetables, your kids ready to go back to school. Of course, we get so obsessed, don't we, with getting that schedule organised. Have they got music lessons? Have they got sport lessons? Are we doing them after school, before school? What are we doing in terms of coaching? Are they learning instruments every second night? But what if I told you that by adding more outdoor play, that could be the answer to your child having greater behaviour and more academic success? I mean, it sounds sort of like a bit of a contradiction to what we think, doesn't it? Well, a new study has suggested that we need to include more outdoor play in our schools. Associate Professor Brendan Hyman is an award-winning former teacher. He's a researcher in sport and physical education at Charles Sturt University. And he's been looking at how outdoor play is essential to children's well-being. Brendan, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What is the link between outdoor play and curriculum outcomes and our student behaviour?
Great to join, Georgie, and good morning. Yeah, look, it's something that is heavily part of our school day. So much is, what we're finding is focused within the classroom. So in this instance, we've done a survey of teachers across the world and basically seen what's happening between outdoor play prioritisation and value in schools and what's happening in the classroom. And teachers, as you've said, they've linked it better concentration in class, what's happening outdoors, if it's really quality, reduced conflict, stronger relationships, a sense of belonging. So our research with the teachers is basically showing outdoor play, it's not just about burning that energy, it's a really crucial part of the day where children learn to negotiate, manage their emotions, build friendships, develop independence, all these things. So not actually separate from the real focus of learning that happens like in the classroom.
Because I suppose, Brent, I used to be a secondary teacher and we would always, I suppose, do a bit of bribery, if we're honest, that, you know, if you're good, you can go out and play. It's always been used as a bit of a reward, hasn't it? But you're saying, and this study is saying, that we need to actually be using play as a form of learning.
Yeah, absolutely. So there is research out there that these periods of learning time outside those structured, you know, scripted classrooms, it can equate to around 1.5 years of schooling, you know, across the entire primary and secondary. And what's really interesting is that despite it really helping kids' well-being these days, you know, they've still got COVID phase recently and, you know, we had all the impacts of that. We've got the digital addictions and we know how important nature is to be really restorative for the kids and getting out there. But it's just really the teachers saying it's segregated. Mm-hmm. So the teachers highly value this time in school, so that they've actually given it a high value and prioritisation. But what they're saying is, like, the systems are just so focused now on literacy and numeracy, testing, all that sort of thing, that they gave it a 4 out of 10, the difference between the priority of what's happening outside the classroom and what's happening within the classroom.
Brendan, are our teachers equipped to understand outdoor play as a form of learning? Like, is that something that they need training in to actually help our kids use learning to play more effectively?
Yeah, and this is the crux of it. It's a great question. So the teachers rated their training to supervise and engage with kids outside the classroom, like during these play experiences, they gave it a 2 out of 10. So unless they really had exposure to early childhood training, they hadn't really experienced any formal preparation. You know, they've seen some safety signs outside, you know, around playground safety or a manual, but haven't actually received that guidance around, you know, the complexities with injuries and social conflicts and territorial type stuff that are heavily part of the jobs of all the, you know, over 300,000 Australian teachers that they've got to do every day. It's incredible.
We're obviously in a week, Brendan, where the weather is a huge factor, though. Do we need to consider particular areas of Australia, of course, and climate change? Do we need to adapt and evolve how we approach outdoor play? And also maybe, Brendan, some kids mightn't like going outdoors. How do we factor that in as well? I mean, some kids just prefer to be inside and find the playground a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess play doesn't have to be at lunchtime. I mean, we know the research is really emphasising the importance of being outdoors, and there's opportunities for that. And on hot days like, you know, we've experienced this week across the country, it's the timetabling can really be looked at. So I've done a lot of research looking at that level of preparation for teachers as well. And it is quite scattered out there across disciplined areas. You know, there's different advice from sports, from health, mm-hmm. you know, education's got their own viewpoints as well and guidelines, but unless they actually hear it from their school leadership, so there isn't a lot of preparation when they go through their training programs to be like, right, today's, you know, 38 degrees, these kids are going to be exposed outdoors. What are the best practices to really support them, whether it's their clothing, where they should be playing, what are temperature thresholds and all that sort of thing. So there's not a lot of guidance for teachers. As a teacher myself, and I jumped back in the classroom for a little while recently, your bandwidth as a teacher, you are so focused on that next lesson, you know, like, have I got the resources? Is the space booked? The learning outcomes? And then suddenly you're exposed to some of the most complex parts of your day outside when they do, you know, environmental scanning, the injuries, the conflict, the high stakes. And it's something that isn't as scripted as all this training and preparation that they have for the classroom. That's all scripted and the most unpredictable nature of their job.
It's certainly a moving beast. I'm going to jump to a caller, Marty from Soldiers Hill. Marty, thanks for holding. What would you like to share?
Oh, hi, Georgie. Yes, I've got a couple of daughters and also been a teacher as well, and I do know that when they've been outside or even in an indoor environment, if they're free to explore and, you know, follow their own curiosity, I find they come back to a task refreshed and just sort of ready to get on to the next thing because they just haven't had that structure, you know, that has to encourage the brain to do a certain thing. They're sort of free to explore and go with their own intuition, which I think is really invaluable.
I love that, Marty. Thank you so much for sharing that. Brendan, Thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fascinating to hear about outdoor play and whether our schools can look at. I know a certain school in Ballarat where I'm from has just extended their lunchtime hours and their recess hours for that very reason, to give kids more access, students more access to play. And they've also made longer lessons rather than lots of shorter lessons, so that that pivoting for the students isn't as exhausting, I suppose. So maybe it is something that we're going to look and see if that landscape changes over the next few years. But really appreciate you sharing those fascinating studies with us. Thank you so much for joining us, Associate Professor Brendan Hindman.
Thanks, Georgie. Appreciate it.
Love to hear from you whether you think that outdoor play should be included more so in our primary and secondary schools. Now, coming up, we're going to be talking about whether or not you would be happy with the title of winning a competition for the world's ugliest lawn.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Yes, you're listening to The Conversation Hour. It's Georgie Coghlan with you this morning. I would be mortified if I won the award for the world's ugliest lawn competition. I am extremely pedantic, my husband and I, about our lawns. I love my lawn being clean, beautifully cut. I don't even like leaves on my lawn. I know I might be a little bit obsessive about my lawn, but there is a competition in the world. It's in its third year. It began on the Swedish island of Gotland, and it's not really a stunt. I think it's a clever way to promote water conservation. And it's a competition to win the world's ugliest lawn. And wouldn't you know it, the winner is not only from Australia, the winner is from Kyneton in Victoria. He is the proud winner of the world's ugliest lawn, and he joins us now. Jono Kuhn, is this something that you're proud of?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good cause to be involved in promoting water conservation. So, yeah, I'm very proud to have an ugly lawn, or the world's ugliest.
Congratulations, Jono. I should have started with congratulations. Beauty is obviously in the eye of the beholder. Can you please share with us, to give our listeners a picture of, what does this lawn of yours look like?
Well, at the moment, probably why I won, it looks quite dry. it's quite long. It's brown grass, and I've never watered it. A lot of people probably wouldn't call it a lawn. They'd say, "Hey, mate, that's not a lawn. That's just grass." but I don't think of that as a negative thing. I don't use herbicides, and I only mow it infrequently or brush cut it infrequently. So yeah, it's long grass at the moment, and I hope that is doing its bit for being habitat for insects.
Jono, I understand the judges described your lawn as, quote, like kids' hair after a lice treatment gone horribly wrong. That's the lighthearted side of it. But there's a really beautiful meaning and, I suppose, purpose behind what you're doing, because you've mentioned sort of biodiversity. Why should we be leaving our lawns alone and not being like what I'm like, which is cutting them and having them beautifully manicured? What have you seen come into your lawn in terms of the types of insects, the types of birds, the type of wildlife that's come in? Why should we be doing this?
Well, basically I do it, and I don't have a great philosophy about it. I'm not expecting other people to do the same. It's all about biodiversity and difference. But a lot of the Kyneton is full of exotic species. It's almost 100% exotic species. And I leave my garden to nature, and nature, that's what nature has to use, is exotic species. But I'm finding that most of the insects, I'm a bit of a obsessive with iNaturalist. Mm-hmm. Most of the insects are native insects, and the same with the birds. A lot of the birds that visit our garden are native birds.
And I was watching a little video on your garden, and you've got chickens in there, and you've got, is it microbats are coming at night?
Well, yeah, that's one of my favourite things about living here. I mean, the microbats are everywhere, but I like to go out at dusk and watch the microbats circling overhead and picking insects out of the sky. it's one of the good things about living here.
Jono, did you enter yourself to the competition, or did someone dob you in?
Yeah, well, I heard about it last year, and I thought, oh, this is great. I like the humour of it, and I like the cause. And these people are my sort of people, so I just thought I'd put in an application to support their cause. And then I put in an application again this year, and not expecting anything, but, yeah, I won.
Now, you're a professional groundskeeper, which I find hilarious, at a school. So aren't you putting yourself out of a job?
Well, not really. the school that I'm the property manager for is 1,100 acres of bush in the Kerry Valley in the Macedon Ranges. So I've well and truly got my work cut out for me. but we do similar things with the grass there. We don't irrigate. We try and manage the weeds. We're in fact trying to bring back and re-veg a lot of the bush. And yeah, so we treat it in a similar way. But we do have a high fire danger there, so I have to be on the mower a bit more.
Well, they sound like very lucky students there, Jarno, to have someone that's so passionate about lawns. I want to know when you're going to tell the students, they're all heading back to school, of course, either today or tomorrow, what do you think they're going to say to you, and did you get some sort of trophy? What did you win?
Well, the kids will be back tomorrow. We start most days with a morning meeting, and I'll wear my trophy, which was a secondhand shirt, which was... a second-hand T-shirt, which I think the first winner or the last winner maybe of Gotland's ugliest lawn, I think he made it for himself and then lost it to Australia. So I'll have to send on that T-shirt to the next winner next year.
Oh, and, Jarno, I love everything about this. I love the fact that even the trophy is recycled. So it's a second-hand T-shirt.
It's secondhand, yes. Yeah. I'm going to look after it. I'm not wearing it when I walk the dogs every morning. it's kept away especially.
Oh, I love this story, Jarno. I love everything about it. I love what you're promoting. I love that your students are going to be so proud that you won. Hang on the line with us, Jarno, because we're going to talk now to Dr. Jock Gilbert. He's a senior lecturer at RMIT University Landscape Architecture Programs. Dr. Jock, thanks so much for joining us. I suppose we're jumping now to the other side of the fence in asking you, why is it so important that we have competitions like the world's ugliest lawn? What do they do environmentally to benefit us?
Yeah, thank you. And it's a wonderful story. I really love what Jarno is doing and what he's putting forward. I think from my perspective, there's obviously all of the environmental and individual positives and benefits that Jarno's put out in terms of flora and fauna and the little insects that live there. But it's also a very sort of cultural and socially constructed landscape thing is the lawn. So, you know, at one end we've got the really highly manicured, well-watered, well-fertilised, beautiful green lawn.
That's mine, Dr. Jock. That's my lawn.
Well, it's kind of mine too, but I must admit I'm probably somewhere in the middle. And then at the other end we've got, Jarno. And I think what Jarno's doing and what the award does in general is puts that the perspective of the green manicured lawn. It just gives us a different perspective as to what a lawn can be, and that opens up lots and lots of opportunities for rethinking what a lawn is, how it works, what we need to do, at a kind of local government scale particularly, but what we can do as individual humans too.
Well, I suppose we've been focusing a lot. I'm a bit of a garden fanatic, and we've seen a lot of terms like these trendy terms like rewilding. And so is what Jarno's doing is a bit similar to rewilding his backyard, which is going to increase the biodiversity. And given we are such a hot climate, particularly in summer, is it that only a good thing for the environment that we're not only increasing our biodiversity, we're hopefully reducing the evaporation from the grass? It seems like Mother Nature is the winner here.
Oh, absolutely. Having said that, there are two sides to that story as well, because evaporation is not a bad thing. Obviously, that cools things down for us.
Okay.
But, and you know, it creates what we call the small water cycle. So the water, you know, goes in, soaks in, produces growth, and then comes back out as evaporation, and it does help to keep us cool. But when it's purely done as a visual thing, then I think it is we have to think about what are we putting our resources towards, mm-hmm. particularly in the sorts of weather that we're encountering at the moment, and where could that water be better spent. But you know, in terms of the way that public space is configured, Europe and the UK particularly. You know, a lot of Parisian public space is constructed of wild, unmown lawn, mm-hmm. If you like. And in Hyde Park in London, towards the end of summer, there's a mowing regime where the long grass is mown in strips.
Right.
So, and you can create mown rooms in amongst the long grass. So there's other things that you can do with it. Once you've got it, it almost becomes a palette that you can start to use and rethink the way that we're doing things, which gives space for all of those other little critters that Jarno's having a wonderful time with, and allows us to also use them in ways that we, you know, think we ordinarily would as humans, like, you know, barbecue spaces and things like that.
Yeah, I do love the way that it makes us rethink public spaces, doesn't it? And everything used to be so beautifully manicured, and I love the way that we can maybe look at that creatively and try and introduce this concept of rewilding almost into our public spaces. So, Jarno, just before we let you go, what are you going uh-huh. to do to try and maintain your title? Are you going to be trying to win this again next year or the end of this year?
Oh, no. I think someone else, there's lots of people that enter this competition, and I think someone else has to win it next year. So that'll be great. The more people that are at least bringing up this as an idea, the better, I think. So rather than just us doing, you know, going to the nursery and getting whatever we can and expecting that to grow without too much effort from us.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you need to wear that T-shirt as much as you can. Keep it looking fresh and clean and getting ready to hand over. And all the best with letting your students know about the award. I'm sure they'll be absolutely stoked. And thank you so much to both Dr. Jock Gilbert and for Jarno Coon for joining us this morning on Conversations. Let's go to some texts now. We were talking earlier today about the importance of outdoor play and whether our schools need to have more outdoor play, because they're showing now through a great international study that there is a link between outdoor play and curriculum outcomes and student behaviour. One text here, let's just call recess playtime and make it longer. Some children need to be taught to play, but most just need some play opportunities. Play, by definition, is self-directed. Early childhood teachers and play therapists know how to observe play and notice strengths and weaknesses. All teachers could learn this skill. Thank you, Jay, from Alinda. We have another text here. I'm 75. When I was in primary school, it wasn't called recess. It was just called playtime. Yes, it's called playtime for me as well. That seems like maybe we could return to the old days and call it playtime. Steve from Bensdale has texted in, yes, more unstructured outdoor play, not more structured competitive sport. Thank you, Steve, sharing your thoughts there. And Mark from Footscray, it should be called the Mark, you're pulling in to talk about the world's ugliest lawn. It should be called the anti-nature strip. Interesting. I like it.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is the Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
You're listening to the Conversation Hour. I'm Georgie Coghlan. Thrilled to be with you today. We have been talking about outdoor play and whether our schools need more outdoor play, based on a study indicating that that would help our students be more resilient and potentially get better grades. Christian, you're calling in from Haddon. What would you like to share?
I think, Georgie, it would be great to keep the name recess maybe for primary, but for secondary, maybe look at changing it to a term maybe more like interval.
Oh.
Interval is a term that I used when I was teaching, because it really, for me, was like showing that having a break is part of work. You know, we do it as adults.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, we have our breaks, we have our intermissions. It's a, you know, a term we use in theatre, in the arts. And I think it's just a great term to really, it just reflects on what it is. You know, we are having a break. We're switching off our brains and just having a lot of fun. So
I
think it's just a great term for high school.
I love that.
You know, playtime is great, but I can't really imagine many, you know, 16, 17-year-olds using that term, playtime, very liberally.
You're so right. They wouldn't. They'd think that would be a bit daggy, wouldn't it? And you've actually, Christian, made me completely rethink the word interval. You know, I've never sort of thought of it. I've always never really challenged that word and sort of thought, oh, I wonder why it's called interval. But that it's almost like a reset, isn't it?
Absolutely. And look, it is probably more of a formal term that we've been using in school. But, you know, it subtly prepares kids for, I guess, you know, those work habits we have later in life. And, you know, we're not calling our break at work playtime or something a little bit more trivial. So why not make it into them, make it a little bit more formal?
Love it. Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Christian. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Georgie.
Let's go to Megan from Surrey Hills. Hi, Megan.
Hi. How are you?
I'm very well. What would you like to share?
Oh, no, just having worked through anxiety as a problem myself and getting on the other side of it, I just think reset's a nice thing. If you were feeling a bit anxious in class and not coping with the activity, you just go out and have a nice reset.
Absolutely, Megan. And what I love too is our schools seem to be coming, which is, you know, timely and wonderful, is a lot more considerate of not only our neurotypical students but our neurodivergent students who do need that reset, potentially, you know, maybe more than other students. I know that some parents, Megan, when their child used to maybe have, say, a singing lesson during lunchtime, realised that that sort of wasn't working for their child because they needed that reset to just completely forget about things to then go back into the classroom. Do you relate to that?
Yes. And my father was a physics professor in Queensland. I migrated here. And his biggest thing in life was that children needed to observe to learn.
That's interesting.
When you're outside, you're observing. So if you went to the zoo, Dad would say, go to the lion's den for 3 hours and watch the lion. Don't go around the whole zoo.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, well, you'll look into it. You do find that repetitive learning doesn't get you very far, but actually observing does. So when you're on a reset, you observe. So
and
double thing.
Megan, now that you're a fully fledged adult, what do you do to reset your anxiety now? Does that involve some form of play?
It does, yes. I do, like, I go for walks, but because I have the anxiety, the ladies made me bounce a ball from my left to my right. So I get a ball and I just bounce it up against a wall with my left hand and my right hand, go across. Like, yeah.
Great. So that's like a sort of a physiological mind reset for your mind.
Yeah, but also when you think about in Japan, they did this thing where they took business people and they made them run around the streets at lunchtime, and then they made others go into a forest and run around the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So most schoolyards have got nice trees in Australia. We're lucky. Mm. And they found that you're healthier if you get out in nature. So there's another reset reason.
I love it. Thank you so much, Megan. I've loved hearing your story. Thank you for sharing with us.
Bye. Thanks.
So earlier in the show, we talked about the fact that whether you would like to wear a flannelette shirt to work. I'm from the country. So flannos, or flannies, as we used to call them in Warrnambool, they've very much been part of my childhood. Would you like to wear a flanny to work? Would you be allowed to wear a flanny to work? Well, let's find out whether you could be someone that potentially might have to fight to wear a flannelette shirt to work. Mark Delbon is a Griffith City councillor, and he fought hard to make sure that he could wear his flannelette shirt to work. Mark, why is a flannelette shirt so important to you?
I didn't have to fight that hard. We have great councillors. And welcome to Griffith, New South Wales, in the heart of the Riverina.
Thank you, Mark. Right? Great to be there.
Best little city in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I didn't have to fight hard to keep my flannelette shirt. Everybody is their own individual up at our beautiful Griffith City Council, and everyone wears a neat and tidy attire.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the word. and they look respectable, and it all came about. The government had implemented some new code of practices for all councils.
So, Mark, I want to get straight to the straight to the flannel.
Yes.
Why do you love a flannel? Why do you feel like a flannel is so important to your identity?
Well, I'm a farmer, and I've been brought born, not brought. No one buys me. I've been born and bred up with flannelette shirts, and that's how I'm comfortable. I wear other shirts and other attires, but when I'm out in the farms or around the town, you'll either find me in a flannelette shirt or maybe a polo, depending on the weather condition. But the thing is, when I was running for council, that was me. I was just wearing a flannelette shirt when I was lobbying for a councillor, and it just and that was it. And it sort of became my trademark from the community. But I didn't go out especially to wear a flannel as a trademark. That was me, and that's how people recognise me.
So you feel yourself. You feel like you're being authentic, and feel yourself when you're wearing a flannel.
Yeah,
love it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it gives me how can you say more confidence is because I'm not putting on something I'm not usually wearing at that time. You know what I'm going to say?
Yeah.
And the community they know the community of Griffith City community and the local LGA are very smart people. They know that if you're trying to be someone you're not, and if I was trying to be someone I'm not, right,
they would pull me
up straight away.
Oh, I hear you, Mark. I'm a country girl, so you know you've got to be authentic, and you're very on trend because you know Tay Tay, you know Taylor Swift.
Yes.
Well, I mean,
we're not on speaking terms at the moment because I don't know what that. No.
Well,
because I don't know that well.
Right.
I'd like to be in speaking terms.
Well, that's another segment for another day. But you're on trend because, see, Tay Tay was wearing a flannel shirt for her album Evermore not that long ago, Mark. So I love that you're very much on trend here. Okay, and I suppose just to play devil's advocate, does it mean, though, that we're going to go now to the singlets and the thongs, or are you keeping it quite formal?
No. It's nothing like that.
Okay.
You've got to have respect still for the council and for wherever you go. Mm-hmm. So it's not about singlet and thongs and shorts and this and that. No.
Good.
It's about neat, tidy and presentable. And nothing about singlet thongs and that, because I personally won't put up with that.
I don't think Tay Tay would like that either. I think she's happy with the flannel, but I think she would draw the line at the thongs and the singlet. But I love this, Mark. I love that you have started a conversation. I want to hear from you at home, wherever you're listening. Should Mark be able to wear his flannel at the council meetings? What are your thoughts on flannels in the office? But, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. You keep wearing that flannel.
Well, you're welcome, because I've had interviews, believe it or not, from ABC New Zealand yesterday.
Oh, my goodness. Look at you. You're all over the world.
Now that you just said that, somebody said their friends from overseas, I don't know if it was the Netherlands or somewhere like that, said, Mark, our friend told us that they heard about Mark Delbon's flannel.
Well, so, Mark, can you please remember us when you get super famous, that we were the ones that called early?
No.
And all the best. I have to go because I'm going to talk now. Thank you, Mark, for joining us. Enjoy the flannel. I have to talk now to Dr. Emily Brayshaw, because, Dr. Emily, you're going to give us some fashion history about the flannel. What are your thoughts on Mark wearing a flannel in the office?
Well, I grew up in the country. I'm a country girl. I grew up on a farm.
Yes.
So I'm all for Mark wearing his flannel at work.
Love it.
I think what is going on here, though, and what the controversy was, is that since the late 17th century, when the fabric of flannel was first developed in Wales, there was like this connection of flannel with working class people, because it became a popular product on Welsh farms and in the UK for fighting the country's cold, wet, windy climate.
Mm-hmm.
And so throughout sort of ever since then, we do have flannel and flannelette, the fabric, as sort of a fabric used by the working classes and embodying working class masculinity, right?
Yes.
We've got these macho associations with lumberjacks, cowboys, frontiersmen, tradies. In Australia, of course, it's farmers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Even in 1919 in Australia, there was a bit of a kerfuffle where Bundaberg meeting of disgruntled unionists accused the then Labor Queensland Premier Ted Theodore of forgetting his humble origins. And one speaker predicted, after the next election, Mr. Theodore will be back in his flannel shirt with us.
Who would have thought that the flannel, the flannel would be so... have such an interesting and checkered history, Emily. I mean, I'm running out of time.
There with checkered.
Do you like that? Checkered.
What's really interesting is that Mark is wearing his working class attire and bringing it into an environment and workplace that has long been considered white collar.
Yes, yes.
And that's what this tension's all about now. And I think as long as Mark is keeping it neat and clean, and he said he is, then, you know, why can't our boundaries of what we consider acceptable workwear shift?
Well, we always prefer to have authentic people
that's
in our
it,
lives, wouldn't we, Emily?
And
also,
we vote for the people who we see reflect our values.
True,
and Mark's reflecting the values of, you know, the people he's representing in Griffith.
100%. And do you remember, I mean, look, I'm going to assume here, I'm older than you, I'm assuming here, Emily, but do you remember Nirvana and Pearl Jam? They turned the flanny into this
and
sort
of course,
anti-fashion symbol almost.
They did, but it's long been sort of, like, again, it ties in with working class and with leisure as well. So, you know, yes, it was sort of a rebellious statement that they picked up from the punks who did it with tartan, of course, which is another type of flanny.
Yes.
But again, it's this anti-authoritarianism. And when you bring that symbolism into like a more formal environment, like a city council, maybe people are going to feel a kind of little bit of unease around that.
Oh, I know, but come on, you know, if it makes us feel a little bit more comfortable and if most importantly, if it makes Mark feel like him, down with it. Emily Brayshaw, I have learnt a lot about the flanny today, so thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much, everyone, for calling in and you're sending your text messages. Would love to hear from you tomorrow as well. That would be fantastic, so make sure you call in. Chat to you tomorrow.